unscripted, no makeup, live from the FDA. Welcome, Vinay Prasad. Great to see you.
It's great to be here, Marty. It's great to be joining.
And we got Sanjala Jan Nagpal, who is an awesome PhD health policy expert who is with us in the commissioner's office. So great to see both of you guys. And I don't know exactly what we're doing, but we're having a conversation. And this is just going to be some civil discourse here, having fun. And I think it's good for people to see what we're talking about, how we're thinking about things, instead of the FDA kind of being a black box of, you know, what's going on inside the agency.
Absolutely, Marty. I think ultimately the FDA serves the American people, and it's really great for the American people to directly have access to the commissioner to hear what you're thinking and what initiatives you're sparking here. And too often, so many articles about the FDA are behind a paywall for industry insiders only. And we're going to try to make the FDA accessible to the average person in America.
Look at the glass box.
In the glass box here with a beautiful view of FDA campus, not the black box.
Yes.
Look at this beautiful campus here. It is going to be lined up with a farmer's market on Tuesday, thanks to, shout out to Melanie, who's in the background there. And it's going to be every week. We're going to do it every single week. Maybe even some seed oil-free food trucks, who knows?
Well, I mean, obviously, healthy food is an important initiative that you're taking on. Yeah,
big part of the program. That's part of what you're working on, Sanjala, is healthy food. So we got big goals on that front. So it's great to have Vinay Prasad here, one, because he's a great scientific mind. Two, he wants to serve our country. And three, he thinks and looks like Albert Einstein in terms of his hair.
Now that you say that, yeah.
It's the regulatory haircut. So
it's
the regulatory haircut. Regulation. Yes, but I'm excited to be here and to join FDA and try to work in service of the American people and try to bring innovative products to market.
And you're going to be working at CBIRD. You want to tell folks what CBIRD is, since we've got some science people and some non-science people listening.
Maybe everyone's listening. I mean, CBIRD, we govern a huge portfolio of medical products, including vaccines, gene therapy, cellular therapy. A lot of the most innovative things you read about in the news are things coming from CBIRD. Not to say the other departments here don't do innovative products. They do. But I think I'm particularly excited about what's been coming out in the last decade through CBIRD division. And we hope to, you know, always strike the balance between data, evidence, innovation, and entrepreneurial spirit of America. So that's what we're going to do.
Does that sound good to you, Sanjala?
Sounds exciting, although I have a lot of questions about how you're going to approach it.
Okay, yes. So tell me.
So, you know, there are a lot of headlines out there about you being, you know, kind of a critic of the administration and kind of how things have been handled in the past with a lot of those products you talked about. And that maybe you're anti-vax, but I know that that's not true.
Ooh, well.
So tell us a little bit about what, you know, why have you been critical, particularly in the vaccine space, and help everyone understand, you know, kind of your thinking behind that.
So, I mean, I think vaccines are like drugs, which is that when given at the right time and the right moment to the right person, they're life-saving. But just like drugs, they need to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis and always taken to the context that you're giving. And Marty and I, throughout the pandemic, we were proponents of vaccines for the people in whom it had a huge benefit. But we were always a bit skeptical from a scientific standpoint about perhaps overdoing it in some low-risk populations.
Wait a minute. You don't think a healthy, thin 12-year-old girl needs a seventh COVID shot?
Seventh versus the eighth versus the ninth versus
It's an unknown.
It's an unknown. And it also is a way in which the United States has never been in line with peer nations across Europe. And so that's not anti-vax. It's pro-science, trying to bring the best available science to answer these questions. You know, the media, in many cases, in my opinion, they sort of misrepresent the concepts that we're talking about at FDA. They have sort of a superficial view of what we're doing, and in some ways they kind of miss the mark. But in terms of, you know, what I've been doing for 15 years, I'm a professor, I'm a hem-onc doctor. Probably no one's given, or few doctors have given as many vaccines as I have because I took care of a lot of patients post-autologous stem cell transplant.
Immunosuppressed.
We gave, and you need to give these patients vaccines. So, you know, we love vaccines when done right, when given appropriately, when based on solid evidence, and we're going to hold up that standard at FDA.
I thought your media coverage was actually good. On the whole, it was good, which is, you don't always see that.
I think that's right.
I wanted to have a low expectation and come in high,
No, but I think there are a lot of questions, a lot of excitement and enthusiasm. I saw something this morning saying, you know, the scientific community is finally seeing everything that both of you championed, you know, early on during the peak of the pandemic, right? You were early tracking the evidence and not everybody was on board, and now they're seeing it. But there was some kind of talk about maybe you've been unfair about how things were handled, you know, from a policy perspective, because in the moment of crisis, you kind of, like, you don't have time to collect the evidence. So I think something I would ask both of you is, how are you thinking about balancing kind of pace of innovation, right? We've all been outside of government and we've seen firsthand, you know, innovation goes faster than the government policy, right? And I know that's something that we're all trying to work really hard to close that gap. But how do you balance speed with scientific rigor, to your point about needing to get the right evidence in moments where you have crisis and things that need to be acted on?
And in light of our new post-approval monitoring process, where we're going to be able to do big data analyses of signals, safety and efficacy signals in big data after approval that we've never been able to do before. That gives us a whole new lens that we've never had.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and to this point about what Marty and I were arguing throughout the pandemic, one point I want to make is that our positions were probably the center point of most Americans, and eventually, a lot of the issues that we were out ahead of the curve on, people have come to our position after 6 months or 12 months or 2 years and forgotten that they held a different position all along. That's one. And
the data caught up, in other words. You're talking about prolonged school closures, masking toddlers,
we were
vaccine.
Critics of these, yeah, from the beginning. And that speaks to how you appraise evidence, not to get caught up in groupthink. Try to be open-minded when you look at the evidence. So that's one. I think that the public is very close to where we are on a lot of these issues. I'm not sure about, you know, all the media coverage, but definitely the public.
Should we invite some of the media to just be a part of this conversation? I mean, I think it'd be good to have a reporter or a couple.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, I think the more discourse, the better, right? So if they've got questions, probably some people out there in America have those questions. Let's bring them in. Let's have a conversation. Let's bring them in right here. Let's get another chair. Put them right here and
we have
a conversation.
Love to do it. And, you know, some of it is a matter of, you know, how do you explain to the American people and to reporters, what should the control arm be in a clinical study? How do we think about that? What kind of questions are we answering with potentially different control arms? That's something that was in the news a lot, but I didn't see an explainer about what exactly the science is around control arms in clinical trials, which goes back a long way.
So for those of us who are not as sciencey, kind of in the weeds as you are.
Laboratory science.
Yeah, laboratory science, sorry, good point. Break it down. So are you saying that we've made decisions, like, no, this agency has made decisions rooted in evidence, but you're talking about a different standard of evidence. So explain.
Well,
that.
I mean, I think ultimately there, you know, we get excited about innovative medical products just as the FDA always have. We all continue to believe in a flexible regulatory standard, taking into account the context of a disease, whether it's rare, if it's dire. We will continue to be flexible. There's not going to be a light switch change here. But around the edges, I think there were a number of missteps along the way. I think the public recognizes those missteps. That's why some products the FDA has approved, as Marty points out, the majority, 85% of healthcare workers don't want a booster that the FDA granted authorization for. And we really aren't sure about kids and how many doses they need, and healthcare workers who just had COVID, whether they need another booster. And these are important scientific questions that the public deserves an answer on. And there we might try to bring science to answer these questions.
I mean, I think of it as gold standard science and common sense both. We got to blend them both. And there's no hard and fast rules on this. And so, you know, I hear about these rare disease conditions that might affect, you know, a couple hundred kids or, you know, a small population. And that's not that different from incurable cancers that I've seen in my career, that you've seen in your career. You're a hematologist, oncologist. How do you think about those?
I mean, I think that you have to have tremendous regulatory flexibility for rare diseases that severely impact small groups of people, where running randomized clinical trials might be very difficult or impossible to do.
Impossible sometimes,
perhaps.
Yeah.
And we need to embrace new technologies, innovative pathophysiology in terms of how to assess those products. At the same time, we also want to protect those patients from potentially harmful products. So we will continue to strike the balance at FDA between those two things. And I think FDA has always been committed to being flexible and listening to the communities impacted by rare conditions.
Some words of wisdom he's dropping here. I mean,
I'm excited.
I wonder if these AI machines out there are really just Vinay. if they're really just going to Vinay's, he's the one answering all these questions.
Well, AI is a good topic because you've taken an interest in AI in the agency and you're doing some things around it.
Yeah, day one, we said we got to stop just talking about AI, having conferences and panels and frameworks and consensus document. We got to do it, right? We have to actually do it. We got to do it, and now's the time to do it. So day one when I got in, 5 weeks ago now, we started a massive initiative, and we have now the first high-level AI-assisted scientific review that just took place, and the scientific reviewer loved it. I mean, I don't know if we can find him or pull him in here to bring him on the camera, but I mean, what he said about, I don't know if he talked
to you. Yeah, I was reviewing some of the data we talked about. I mean, to go from, it was 3 days down to 6 minutes for just one piece of that review process is tremendous.
Yeah, I think the public that may not be aware, but when a reviewer is thinking about the application for a medical product, we're talking not just hundreds of pages to read, but potentially thousands or maybe tens of thousands of pages to read. And if you have AI brought into that to help you dissect, to cut to the most important parts of it, we can tremendously speed up drug regulation and drug processes, and that's a boon to everybody, patients, the industry, the American people.
It also lets scientists focus on the science, right, and kind of cut out that additional burdensome noise.
You know, I found in busy clinical practice, what drove me crazy was not the hard work or the acuity of that work. I love that. I love hard work. I love high intellectual work. What drove me crazy was the stuff that was unnecessary, the scheduling cases in the operating room, the burden of coding and documenting. It was things that were repetitive.
Still have some notes to finish, Marty. You're not done.
No, all my notes are
You're
done.
All done.
All
You're
my
done.
Notes are done. Yeah. But it's, if you can, I think of it, if we can get rid of some of that redundant busy work, it makes the job more enjoyable. People need to focus on their superpowers here at the FDA. And, you know, I've heard reviewers telling me that they're reading so many things, there's just, some stuff is just repetitive, right? And if AI can grab all the unique facts and summarize them for the reviewer, and they love it, like the reviewer we spoke with, or you spoke with, maybe reviews can be done faster, we can get more decisions out in a shorter period of time. And most importantly, they'll love their jobs more. I mean, that's our job as leaders, to make a great workplace culture for people where they can focus on their superpowers, do their job well, support them, not burden them with red tape and busy work. And, you know, frankly, I mean, there's been some change here, and it's been tough for some folks. There's been some growing pains. And so what we can, my focus has been, what can we do to empower people and give them all the resources they need so they enjoy their work and feel like they're supported?
I think it's also an example of things you've been talking about on modernizing methods and processes here, because as I talk around with individuals across the agency, I mean, they tell me they're doing things that have been the same for 20, 30 years, right? We live in this exciting era of new advancements in, scientific, discovery and technology. I mean, everyone's got smartphones now. I mean, we consume information so differently, and we haven't really kept pace with that. And so I think whether it's AI or some of the new kind of clinical methods and thing we're going to use to test things, that's all part of it.
We have to make our submissions easier. We have to make it so sponsors don't have to fill out information over and over again when they've already told us once. But you're absolutely right. You just can't be the same. You have to always be changing and adapting. And too often in big institutions, that doesn't happen.
So have you seen your new office?
I did see it, yeah.
How is it?
It's nice. It's got a good view here of the beautiful campus. And I mean, all the offices at FDA are really nice. And I do feel sort of an energy being here. And I'm coming from a college campus, so it's a very different energy. It's a productive energy here. Yeah.
I mean, I've loved getting to know so many people here. I mean, these are hardworking Americans that really want to do great things, and it's just awesome to see how they've dedicated their lives to a job that is not a high-profile job, but so critical to our entire world of discoveries and bringing cures and they do it for no credit sometimes. So, I mean, it's just been pretty cool to meet a lot of these folks. So if we get some seed oil food trucks with good food, they deserve it for sure.
We'll get on that.
Cool. So I wonder if you guys think it would be a good idea to do more public stuff here.
Yeah.
We're at the main center part, sort of the nerve center of the agency. People might be able to see on the camera the beautiful campus here where most of the scientific review takes place. What if we brought in, I don't want to call them stakeholders, but we brought in different experts on different topics and just had an open discourse. Just bring them in, have a round table. You don't have to go through all the red tape of, people coming through an official commission, which has a whole lot of bureaucracy and costs. We just invite people in for a round table discussion. Let them talk passionately about all the scientific topics that they think are important to talk about that we have not been talking about, and then let that discourse take place, and we can just listen.
I love that.
Things that don't fit neatly within the drug advisory committee model, topics that kind of span different groups and different fields. And I know you got a couple of those planned in the summertime.
Yeah, I think we're looking at some pretty cool topics that are emerging in medicine, and we'll probably set up, we might be able to do a roundtable in a couple weeks, I think. I was talking to some of our folks back there, and I think Bigfoot is supportive. I don't know where he is right now, but
our AV expert.
He's one of our AV experts. Bigfoot around? Okay.
He's monitoring your audio.
Yeah, there he is. And just so people know, we're not assigning you a nickname that you haven't assigned to yourself already. Yeah, so.
Self-appointed.
Maybe. Self-appointed,
yeah.
And we have seen Bigfoot. For a while, it was like steroids resulting in somebody improving in the ICU. Like, everyone heard of it, but nobody actually saw it.
Yeah.
And we called that, it's like Bigfoot. No one actually saw the benefit.
Never witnessed this effect.
Ultimately, everyone did see it. But
but I think those conversations would be good to be more proactive, right? And actually, follow the evidence as it's coming out to have those discussions in real time.
Yeah, proactive. And discussions that include the media, that include patients, patient advocacy groups, the industry, having more of those here, and experts who've been studying these topics for 20 years. I think it'll be good. FDA, to me, as an outsider prior to coming here, the closest I ever got to understand the thinking of FDA officials is to read the rare JAMA viewpoint or to try to pour through, the letter that they're submitting the company or the medical review. And so I think it's a complete change of pace that you're going to be doing these podcasts and videos directly to American people, to patients. I think I haven't seen anything like that, and I've been following the FDA closely for 20 years now.
I think we just got to talk. We got to just talk as we go, talk openly and honestly, just share with people what we're thinking. Within our legal constraints, obviously we can't talk about products that are currently under review at the FDA. People ask, what about this product and that product? Well, we have to follow the law, but we can talk about how we think about things. And I think one thing that developers and inventors appreciate is predictability. Now, understanding how we generally think about things.
Well, that's always a way in which I thought it was unfair. On the one hand, the manufacturer of a specific product, they get a letter, they can spin it and frame it any way they want, but the FDA can't reply in the press to try to clarify, to provide additional context. So we are, in one way, we are a little bit of a disadvantage, but we'll try our best to convey the broader principles of regulatory science that govern not just any individual approval, but all of the approvals. And hopefully the media will start to understand, what we're doing.
There's often details in a product decision that the public is not looking at or doesn't know about. So it is pretty nuanced. And I've even found myself at some time saying, yeah, that's strange that this got approved or didn't approve. And then as I learn more, you realize there's actually a good reason for it.
I would say FDA reviews are like a pomegranate. There's fruit in there, but it's a heck of time to get it out. And it sometimes feels that way.
Right, well, but policy and science is nuanced, right? It's not just black or white. There's a lot to consider.
Exactly. Which is why we should think of everybody as contributing valuable scientific input rather than sort of a tribalism of people being for or against anything out there. And so that's the culture that I think we're trying to build here. So,
Marty, you had mentioned earlier you had some limo story to share with me, but we didn't get around to it.
Yeah, I learned that. This is nuts. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I learned that is nuts, but this is just a little Scooby snack to share with you. So I learned that we'll have foreign inspectors in another country about to inspect a foreign manufacturing site that makes pills or something. And the foreign pharma manufacturing company will pick up our FDA inspectors in limos. And so these visits are so announced, and they're preparing for these visits, that they're basically no inspection, in my opinion.
So this is like a priority of the administration, which is that if you're doing the inspections in the United States, are held to very high standards, including random spot visits. They don't know it's coming. But if you're doing it in some other locations around the world, the standards are apparently much lax. You get a limo service there, and they know when you're coming, which, you know, like all great inspections, if they know when you're coming, they know when to, you know, put out the red carpet. It's like when you came to my place the other day and I was clean inside, you know, it wasn't a mess. Because I knew you were coming.
But don't See, drop I get the random drop-ins, yeah, you know, my office is right next door.
Well, I agree. Like, the element of surprise is what drives the power of an inspection, and that's a big part of what the FDA does. We've got over 300 officers with guns and badges, and many more that are involved in investigations. The FDA has been involved in some major raids and some investigations that have changed the industry. The Elizabeth Holmes case is one example. Mm-hmm. So a scheduled inspection, in my opinion, is basically no inspection.
Right.
So that's something we're changing. We're going to move to surprise inspections overseas, just as we have in the United States. No more limos for the FDA inspectors, and so...
But they keep the badges. I didn't get my badge. I want a badge.
Yeah, I don't know if you get a badge.
I don't get a badge.
Is generally not a badge.
Badge-free. It's a badge-free.
It's a badge-free zone.
I see.
Yeah, now I've got a badge.
I got a badge
I'll show you.
Okay.
But, so fun. So this is good. Should we keep doing this, or was this a colossal failure?
No, I think it's good.
No, this was fun.
We'll see what people think.
Yeah.
Put the video out there.
What's Bigfoot think? Good?
Yeah.
Okay, he's on board.
Yeah,
we'll put it out there, and then we'll try to do them with reporters, we'll try to do them with the public, we'll try to do them with more people, and we'll talk about whatever initiatives we're taking on.
And we'll find a way to get the public to, you know, submit some questions,
and
we can get a sense of themes, and we'll keep asking questions.
Yeah, we'll see what the feedback is. Maybe somebody asked me to comb my hair differently or comb my hair.
I think I'm going to get that feedback.
Well, maybe. Do you think Albert Einstein got that feedback when he would give a lecture?
I think he got a pass, probably, at some point.
I'm sure there's some study out there about his productivity differences.
You know, the headline is going to read, "You comparing me to Einstein," and I guess I'll take it if that's what the headline reads.
Yeah, this is not Albert Einstein.
Yeah, let's just be clear.
However, his hair does have similar representations and overlaps, but no, it's good to see you.
Good to see you.
Welcome to the FDA.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah.
And nice to work with you, too.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Great. Thanks so much, folks. We'll do it again.